Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 10 days following the election, there have been almost 900 reports of harassment and intimidation from across the nation. Many harassers have invoked Donald Trump's name during assaults, making it clear that the outbreak of hate stemmed in large part from his electoral success. There have been reports of the 867 hate incidents. 23 were anti-Trump. These have taken place in almost 50 states all over the country, and we're going to be talking about why this is happening and, as one of our guests suggests, what the president-elect must say to stop this kind of hate in the USA. We'll have two guests with us during the course of the hour. The Southern Poverty Law Center has been doing work fighting hate and bigotry since 1971. Ryan Lenz will be joining us, senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its Hate Watch blog. The program, based in Montgomery, Alabama, is a nonpartisan 501c3 civil rights organization founded in 71, dedicated to fighting hate and bigotry and to seeking justice for the most vulnerable members of society. Their major report just released today. And interestingly, the New York Times also today began the first in a series tracking hate crimes and harassment around the country. Today's is titled Threats of an Anti-Muslim Holocaust. A little later in the program, an investigative news reporter with ProPublica, who's been doing a lot of work on this issue, an investigative reporter will be joining us. And we'll welcome your phone calls during the course of the hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We like to read your messages always. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Ryan, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, the report was very disturbing and extremely interesting. Is it what's going to be a national outbreak of hate? Do you anticipate that these numbers are going to go even higher? And is there anything immediately that could be done to stop these alarming incidents?
Well, I think, I mean, it's almost impossible to predict whether they'll continue. I mean, they have yet gone, I mean, they have yet to slow, that much is clear. So I can't say, I can't really predict whether at what rate they'll climb or not. But I think in this environment and with these numbers showing us that clearly as a result of this election and as a result of the very bruising campaign that, you know, that blew a dog whistle to a number of far-right racist ideologies, that it's time for us to say something. Like us, everyone is American. So my advice, I guess, would be to just speak and speak loudly. If you see these things, make someone aware of it because it cannot go on.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump did in that 60 Minutes interview look in the camera when he was asked about this and said, stop it. Was that enough?
I don't believe so. I mean, after 18 months, you know, of a campaign that even he acknowledged was just brutal, I believe was the word he used, to simply tell a group of people that have felt that they've been marginalized and suddenly have been legitimized as a result of this campaign to stop it doesn't seem to be enough. You know, to tell a racist to stop it is to tell them to change their worldview entirely. And I don't really anticipate most racists to be that understanding of such a command.
The hate incidents you report today have been taking place in almost every state. It's always alarming. All of them are alarming. But to hear what's taking place in schools around the country, you report some of these incidents. A Washington State teacher build a wall chanted in the cafeteria the Wednesday after the election. If you aren't born here, pack your bags, shouted in her classroom. Get out, spick, said in the hallways. These are children in schools.
Well, you know, children are the most impressionable to the world around them. That much is clear. And I think that the fact that we're seeing these incidents, and one you didn't mention that I found particularly disturbing, was middle school students chanting white power as they paraded through the halls of their school, holding up a sign that said Trump Pence. I think children are most impressionable to the environment around them. And the fact that they've accepted this or incorporated it as part of their behavior as a language to address their fellow classmates speaks to just how problematic the normalization of these ideologies is. And it should be a cautionary tale for all of us to speak and speak loudly about how these ideologies have no place in a 21st century functioning democracy that accepts everyone.
Mm-hmm. You also cite at the beginning of the report church vandalism that took place just a week before the November 8 election. A church in Greenville, Mississippi, set on fire, a historically black church. Authorities believe it was an act of voter intimidation. Can you talk about that, and are you seeing more incidents like that? And I know you've tracked these incidents when it comes to anti-Muslim hate, racist hate, anti-LGBT. The list goes on.
Well, we've not seen an increased number of churches being targeted in the aftermath of the election. In the months preceding the election, about 6 months before, there was a rash of church burnings that law enforcement and others questioned whether they were tied to some efforts, maybe not voter intimidation, but certainly of racial intimidation. That's one of the more horrific examples of hate manifest in the real world, and I hope we don't see more of those.
Mm-hmm. You say that a lot of these incidents, and I'm wondering if most of them, they happen on the street? They happen when people just walk past each other? They happen in retail stores? Where are they happening?
Oh, they're happening all over the place. I mean, just this week we saw a video that came out someone had taken on off of a Delta airplane.
Yes.
Where one supporter stood up and started chastising those around him, many of whom he felt that it seemed were Clinton supporters, and I think it speaks not just to let me say this: it seems that something shifted on Election Day. It seems that the hate that we've seen manifest and grow online in largely anonymous forums, the trolling that has been used to attack people for any number of things on Election Day or after Election Day, it seems to have moved into the real world, moved into the streets, into our cafes, into our restaurants, into our schools. And I think that has always been the big concern, that by refusing to address this rising tide of hate and extremism in America, that it would be normalized or it would be accepted as proper political conduct or conversation. For a long time, the racists in America have been vying for a place where they could make their viewpoints politically palatable. And I think with this election, they've found it.
Mm-hmm. Via Breitbart News website, via language that came from the campaign, what legitimized it?
Well, I think the election, to be honest, the fact that Donald Trump was elected. A lot of people felt that there's been all sorts of political punditry discussing what happened in the midst of this election, and I think there's a lot more to come to give us a thorough picture, whether it was disenfranchised or dispossessed white people in rural America who felt that the political system had left them behind, whether it was voter malaise and feeling that the polls were right and that they didn't need to come out. It's a little unknown at this point. But without a doubt, when political figures on a national stage, in the presidency or the race for the presidency is certainly the most national stage we have, start addressing or talking about issues that appeal to white nationalists and white supremacists, and then fail to disavow themselves or to speak or to speak properly about what white supremacy is, that is just a big red stamp of legitimacy. These viewpoints now have a seat at the table. They feel the adherents of them feel. And it's going to take some time to right the ship.
Mm-hmm. What about anti-Trump hate crimes?
There was a small fraction of the more than of the nearly 900 reports. They were there as well, and we speak. We condemn them as those acts of intimidation as well. Politics in this country can be contentious. It is, as many in it say, a contact sport. But I think in no situation and under no circumstances should that discourse fall to the levels they have.
Mm-hmm. Let's center a little bit, because there was a great deal of talk about deporting Muslims by Donald Trump during this campaign. Last week, three mosques in California, one in Georgia, received letters threatening that Donald Trump is going to do to you Muslims what Hitler did to the Jews. The letters were signed, Americans for a Better Way. A couple questions here. Have you been tracking more and more organizations that are just forming as a result of this election? And are you seeing, we saw a great deal of anti-Muslim rhetoric and hate crimes, certainly after 9/11 and certainly since 9/11, there's been a lot of that. Are you seeing an uptick in that kind of hate crime as well?
Let me address. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I you know, it's you're right to point out that after 9/11 we saw a rash, saw an incredible rise in the amount of anti-Muslim rhetoric. What was different about that time from now are a couple of factors. First, there was real leadership at that point in time. You know, President Bush stood up and said properly that Islam is a religion of peace that has been distorted by fanatics in its midst. And it did quite a lot to sort of calm the tensions of the time. But in the years since, since 9/11, we've seen the birth of a cottage industry of anti-Muslim hate, Islamophobia, and bigotry in a number of ways. It seems that that the issues that have been latched onto by the radical right in the United States are almost handpicked from the campaign trail. Anti-immigrant sentiment is on the rise, and we see that in these attacks as well. It's no surprise, I suppose, when Donald Trump begins his campaign by calling Mexicans rapists and promising to build a wall to keep them out. You know, through the course of the campaign, he went on, after a number of Islamic radical attacks, he said that we're going to put a ban on all Muslim immigration in the United States. While these things are clear political overreaches to a problem that we all need to address, indeed, but for those who are full of fear and hate, they translate into stamps of approval and encouragements to continue their fear of the other, and so it's not a surprise to me that anti-Muslim hate is once again on the rise.
Mm-hmm. Put this, if you would, Ryan, in some kind of historical perspective. Southern Poverty Law Center has been around since 1971. You've looked at hate crimes, many of them in the South. Civil rights, achieving civil rights was no easy thing in this country. There were a lot of horrors. How do you compare this era with the founding of the Southern Poverty Law Center?
Well, the SPLC was founded in 1971, which was, a decade after the Civil Rights, almost a decade after the Civil Rights Act passed. And, it was brought about to help enforce or help bring about the reality of what that act promised. It has been a continual battle. It has been a continual fight to bring to this country or to help people recognize that civil rights are are rights for everyone. Over the course of the decades, we've seen hate groups rise and fall, anti-government extremist groups rise and fall, and they have followed, almost predictable models to a point. During times of Republican administrations, for example, anti-government groups fall precipitously, and during Democratic administrations, they rise. We saw that with the election of President Obama. The following year, we saw anti-government groups rise to an all-time high, more than 1,200 groups. Hate groups climbed as well to all-time highs. And through the 8 years of the Obama administration, they rose and fell. But I think we're at a point in time where every model is being challenged, because this political campaign has been like nothing we've ever seen, not in recent memory at least.
Let's take a few phone calls for you. Ryan Lenz is our guest for the first part of the show, and he is senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, editor of its Hate Watch blog. He's also a former Associated Press war correspondent. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Their report, which is a pretty exhaustive examination of the almost 900 reports of harassment and intimidation from across the nation after the election, has just been published today, 10 days after harassment and intimidation in the aftermath of the election. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. And Willem and Colfax, you're with us. Hi, Willem.
Hi. Good afternoon. I guess this is personal for me because my father spent 2.5 years in a German concentration camp, and his brother was executed.
Ooh.
They were both in the Dutch resistance. And he spoke to me about it very infrequently, but what he did say was that this type of divisive rhetoric is very dangerous, and I think that Mr. Trump has engaged in this divisive rhetoric and supported it throughout his campaign. And I think that the results, I think that good people of real Christian values and real American values should stand up to this as much as possible. And the other thing that I thought was that, as far as I'm concerned, he has not really apologized in a heartfelt way. I heard a story about a 10-year-old girl who said that she felt like his apology was like a bully that gets caught on the playground and the teacher makes him apologize. And I thought, wow, that was really perceptive from a 10-year-old, you know, like they say, from the mouth of babes. But he is, you know, somehow it's like his technique is to every day you make a new outrageous statement. That's what leads the press, and then we forget about the statement that he made the day before, and we don't examine. The press, I think, is dropping the ball on that because he is, you know, he's a liar. There's no other word for it. He's a man who lies easily, and that's proven by his own words. This is not some opposition making this up. He is a liar, and I think that for a 70-year-old man, he seems more like a 14-year-old. Well, I don't even want to pin that on a 14-year-old, but his rhetoric and his intellect is very immature, and I think that we need to stand up to this man, you know, and speak out because this is dangerous.
Thank you, Willem, for the call. So it begs a couple questions. How do people stand up to hate crimes? And number two, what are you asking the president-elect to say? What does he need to say to the country to lessen the number of these kinds of incidents, Ryan?
Well, I think he needs to say more than just stop it. And I think he needs to say more than, as he told the New York Times, that he disavows these groups and he's going to seek why they feel energized. I think to anybody who's at all been perceptive over the course of this campaign, it's clear why they were energized. It's clear why they feel they have a seat at the table. And it's clear why they seem to intend to take advantage of this newfound awareness of where they are. I think, you know, more than just saying I intend to look at this, I think Donald Trump needs to prove to the American public, as he says, that he's going to be a president for all Americans. And that might require some more effort than just saying I'm going to look at this.
And how do people stand up to this?
Well, what do you mean?
What is it that people need to do? If they see something happening, if they hear something in school, what do they do? Do they report it? Do they offer assistance in some form?
Well, I think all of the above. I mean, I think the reality about this type of conduct and this type of demonizing and vilification of groups of people based on things they cannot change cannot stand in our culture. We as Americans, all of us, no matter our creed, no matter our sexual orientation, no matter the color of our skin, are united under a common purpose and a common belief in freedom and liberty for all. And I think that if we are to do anything, if we are to confront this evil that is present among us right now, it requires a lot more than just saying something or standing in the midst of it. It requires changing the world around you. It requires making sure that you are the embodiment of the values that you seek and hope for this country.
One more phone call for you, Mohammed in Milwaukee. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi there. I want to chime in, and I'm a Muslim, and I have a large family here in Milwaukee. And, yes, I have been following the campaign, and I listened, for example, to one instance where Donald Trump reported a questionable historical event in 1902 or something, when a general by the name of Pershing, he kind of deterred the Muslim from becoming terrorists by soaking a bullet with pork blood and you know the story. It's very famous. And he said that he killed 49 and then he saved one and said, go tell your people this is the way that you're going to be treated if you become terrorists. This is like an indignation against Islam. So repeatedly, but I'm saying that while this is happening, and this actually, in a way, is an opportunity for Muslims to shine and be the intellectual belief that it is and the great high standard behavior that we are. And this is our best weapon. And I believe we are winning in that sense because a lot of people are accepting Islam not only as a religion but also as a culture. And that's what I think the best way to defeat it is that for the Muslim community to stand up by their intellectual behavior high standard of Islam. We have hope more than fear.
Mohammed, have you known people or have you experienced hate crimes?
All the time. And I don't report it because I reported a couple of times. I was laughed at the police station. For example, I have a sticker on my car say, Islam for you. and that, you know, I reported the guy who gave me fingers and gave me the F, and I reported and gave the number and everything, and they just laughed at me. And I stopped. I just say, okay, I smile. I keep going. But I have gained more friends than enemies, and I think that's our opportunity. You know, Muslims eventually is going to unite and bring back their caliphate, you know, the righteous caliphate, not the bad stupid one that we have ISIS. We are going to unite, and once we unite, Islam is going to be represented not only as individuals, but as a great community, as a state. This is coming to happen. I think that's the biggest fear, is that Muslims unite and become one superpower that would probably take the position of number one leadership from the world.
Thanks, Muhammad, for the call. Should he report those comments that have been made to him? Does it make a difference to do that? Do the police respond?
I mean, I can't say whether, you know, whether individual, I can't speak to the conduct of individual police departments. And if your police department doesn't seem to be listening, I guess speak louder or make sure that people know they're not listening. But yes, absolutely. You know, make sure these instances are known, because what is seemingly an instance that, you know, you can dismiss or stomach as a result of you having to deal with it before, in this environment, they cannot stand.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ryan, very much. We'll put your report released today on our Facebook page.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
And you as well. Ryan Lenz, senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, editor of its Hate Watch blog. He's a former Associated Press war correspondent. We will continue. We are talking about hate crimes. Southern Poverty Law Center releasing a major report on what's happened since the election. And today in the New York Times, this is going to be part of a continuing series this week, tracking hate crimes and harassment around the country since the election of Donald Trump. ProPublica has done a lot of work in this area as well, and we'll be speaking with an investigative news reporter with ProPublica as we continue here on the Ideas Network. A.C. Thompson is joining us now, an investigative news reporter with ProPublica. He's been working as a reporter for 12 years. He was an investigative reporter for San Francisco Weekly, and he worked for the San Francisco Bay Guardian, written for a number of national magazines, received the George Polk Award for local reporting. He's a co-author of the book Torture Taxi, On the Trail of the CIA's Rendition Flights, and he's also working with PBS Frontline series as well. AC, thanks very much for being with us. Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
And ProPublica has done a lot of work on hate crimes. Let's talk about how all of this is reported. You have written in a recent story that the data here is deeply flawed. We need to do a better job of tracking and reporting hate crimes to fully understand what's happening in our communities and how to stop it. How are we gathering information, and how is it flawed?
You know, it is pretty remarkable what's going on. The FBI data that is pulled from a sort of annual report from all state and local law enforcement agencies called the Uniform Crime Reports, that data, when it comes to hate crimes, is by everybody's estimation massively, massively undercounting the number of hate crimes. So James Comey, when the latest data came out, the head of the FBI said, hey, we need your help getting better data on this. Other top officials in the Justice Department have said, hey, the numbers are not, they're not accurate. We need more people to report. What we know is this. The data are submitted to the FBI by state and local law enforcement agencies from around the country, but a lot of them just don't report. So a lot of them just don't even bother to participate in the program. Around 20% of law enforcement agencies in the country don't participate at all. Entire states like Hawaii don't participate.
Why?
I haven't seen anybody give a real explanation for this beyond the basic carrot and stick situation. The federal law says the FBI has to ask for it, the data from the local law enforcement agencies, but it doesn't require the state and local law enforcement agencies to provide it. And so since they're not required to provide it, some of them just don't. That's the only thing that I've been able to figure from this.
Hmm.
In addition, it's quite clear that there are many law enforcement agencies that are not very serious about reporting. So there's only a handful of those that actually participate in the program, the 80% or so that say they participate in the program to record hate crimes and forward them to the FBI. Most of them don't seem to take this job very seriously. So what you see are states, like particularly southern states, where you would expect to see a significant number of hate crimes, what they're reporting to the FBI is almost nothing's happening. So Alabama in 2015 said it had 10 hate crimes in the whole state. Arkansas said it had 5 hate crimes. Mississippi said it had 0. These numbers are hard to believe, and most experts believe that local and state law enforcement agencies, even when they say they're participating in the program, are not being very diligent about forwarding this information to the FBI so that we can have a real picture of what's going on when it comes to hate incidents around the country.
So is it up to the FBI to make sure that the agencies provide the information?
This is what should happen if we want real stats on this. What should happen is the federal law needs to be rewritten to actually require the agencies to provide this information. You know, the FBI's part of it is already there. It says, hey, you have to go out and get it. Now what needs to happen is the agencies, the local cops, the local sheriffs, the state police are going to need to be required by federal law to actually make a real effort to collect the data and supply it.
You've written about some states that are going above and beyond, states like California, where police officers receive training on hate crimes as part of their initial education at the police academy, which, as you say, can help officers identify bigotry-driven offenses. California law requires police and sheriff's deputies to closely monitor hate crimes and share their findings with the California Attorney General and the FBI. Is this an anomaly?
Yeah, I would say most states, they don't have data collection efforts that are that robust. And I'll give you an idea of what California does. California, we can tell, one, how many hate crimes occurred in the state in a given year and were reported to police. But also we can tell how many crimes were actually prosecuted, how many crimes were successfully prosecuted, how many of these hate crimes were prosecuted using actual hate crime laws, or using other parallel criminal codes. So, you know, we have a real sense of, are crimes going up? Are they going down? What is effective in policing them? And what are the hot spots in the state for hate crimes? Not to mention what groups are being targeted most often and what types of crimes are occurring most often. Are we talking about violence? Are we talking about graffiti? Are we talking about verbal intimidation? We have that rich data here in this state. Some other states are quite good as well. Maryland is one. But I would say overall, across the country, there is not this kind of really good reporting.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at something that seems to be pretty troubling, and we talked about it some with our guest from the Southern Poverty Law Center. The direct connection to a single politician, the connection to Donald Trump, the fact that much of it has been, his name has been used in many of these hate messages that have been sent or in verbal confrontations, hate confrontations that have taken place. The fact that it's being linked to our presidential campaign is pretty darn disturbing, isn't it? And I'm wondering if there's a precedent in history for this and what in the world we do about it.
Well, you know, I would say if you look at these far-right movements in the last half century or so, generally the far-right white supremacist-type movements have not been very big fans of either major political party in the country. They have viewed themselves as a force apart mm-hmm. from the major political parties and the political system. What I think has generally been different in this election cycle is the most extreme right-wingers, the white supremacist and white nationalist types, have found what they perceive to be as a fellow traveler in Donald Trump. They don't see him as the perfect candidate, but they see him as the best candidate that has come along in generations, perhaps ever, for their cause. And their cause is kicking everyone who is not white out of the country and basically creating a whites-only homeland that is devoid of Jews, that is devoid of Muslims, that is devoid of Mexican-Americans, that's devoid of African-Americans, and all other people of color. And so they see a first step in the present. They see, you know, the beginning of a road to their white people utopia, right? That's a very, very different position than we've had in my memory in the last 50 years, as far as I can tell in my research. We have not seen that situation. When you go to the far-right websites, the white supremacist websites, Donald Trump's picture is everywhere. Donald Trump is the story for them. There is major, major excitement in Donald Trump. And every time he talks about, we're going to stop immigration, every time he talks about, we're going to stop radical Islamic terrorism, when he talks about Mexicans in this country being rapists and criminals, people love that. In this milieu, in the extreme right, white supremacist milieu.
Would you agree with what Ryan said earlier, our first guest this hour, that Donald Trump needs to make a very forceful statement and probably needs to make it more than once, completely disavowing this kind of behavior, condemning this kind of behavior, and completely disconnecting himself from any alliance with him?
Donald Trump needs to do whatever Donald Trump wants to do. If he wants to ensure that America is a country where all different kinds of people can live together harmoniously and that it doesn't become a white homeland for only European ancestored Americans, then he needs to take serious action and verbally say over and over again, This is a country for all kinds of people. This is a country where discrimination will not be tolerated. This is a country where hate crimes will not be tolerated. If you're going around painting swastikas and writing Trump next to them, or if you're going around painting swastikas and writing Make America White Again, well, that's not something I support. So far, he hasn't done that, but really, it depends on what he wants America to look like.
There are many, many incidents of hate crimes now, but you've had a chance in your reporting to look at many of them. What disturbs you the most about what you have uncovered?
You know, that's hard to say. I think one thing that's worrisome to me is that you see an uptick in hate crimes against Jews, and that to me signals that what we're looking at here is really the effects of a broader white supremacist movement. You know, the Jewish identity was not an issue during the campaign. You know, the talk was about immigrants. The talk was about maybe we should intern Muslims. The talk was about Mexican-Americans. But it really wasn't about people of the Jewish faith. So if you're seeing an uptick in those types of crimes, what that suggests to me is that the white supremacist notion of that the Jews are the enemy, that they must be persecuted and purged from society, these really crazy fascist paleo racist ideas are really circulating along with the sort of toxic stew of things that were discussed during the election campaign. Mm-hmm. And so that's a thing that I think is quite worrisome to me.
Certainly there were statements about the global financial network, et cetera, historically having been used against Jews.
Right, right. And I think there were a couple things that Donald Trump said during the election that could be construed as alluding to some sort of shadowy cabal of Jews that are running the media and financial system. But I think generally that wasn't a place that he went. And so what I think we're seeing is that there are people, more and more people, who are adopting this sort of worldview that views not just people of color, not just people of the Islamic faith, but Jews and all other people who are not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants as being the enemy.
Let's go to phone calls for you. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. A.C. Thompson, investigative news reporter with ProPublica. They've been doing a lot of work on this increase in hate crime following the election of Donald Trump. Dan in La Crosse, hi.
Hi. I've coined the terms disagreebia and disagreeophobia. Would Mr. Thompson please distinguish between phobia and hate on the one hand, and healthy, honest disagreement on the other?
You know, I think having a conversation is a wonderful thing to do. It's the sort of foundation of America, is the ability to express oneself and have a true discussion. I think that a disagreement is not what you're seeing when you see people who are being physically attacked and intimidated and threatened with death and killed, as actually happened in my community, for the color of their skin, for their religious affiliation, for their gender identity, for whom they choose to spend their time with romantically. You know, that is not a healthy disagreement. That's hate.
AC, what happened in your community?
I live in Northern California, near Richmond, California, and we've had both a homicide of an African-American man that the police believe was a hate crime, and we have had what the police are saying is a hate crime and a physical attack on a member of the Sikh faith in Richmond.
Thank you, Dan, for your call. Wayne in Viroqua. Hi, Wayne.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a thought here about, I try to listen to all kinds of news, and I was listening on the Fox channel to Bill O'Reilly, and his position on this was, I'm laughing here, was as follows. He said that the stats don't bear out that there are any significant amount of increase in hate crimes. That was his first thing after listening to what you said about stats. And he put on old film of Louis Farrakhan, and I can see what's happening there is that they're going to use your guest's position kind of against him, of saying he's out there pushing, you know, always disgruntled with Trump being voted in. And, you know, I can see that that's going to be where they're coming from, they being people who don't agree with your guest's view. And, you know, the stations like Fox News, they get listened to a lot. So that's just sort of a kind of a heads up, and if you'd comment on that.
Thanks, Wayne. AC?
You know, there's a real interesting thread, and I get a lot of email about this, and there's a sense among a lot of white folks on the right that there's this whole wave and rash of hate crimes that's going on a daily basis against white folks that are not reported and not documented, and it's part of some media conspiracy to further disempower the white folks who basically have the vast bulk of power in America. That is a thing, that is a trope that is trotted out a lot in Fox News circles, on Breitbart, and these other sort of places like that. Here's the reality. And it's absolutely worth noting. If you look at the most recent FBI statistics, the number one group of people who are victimized by hate crimes are African Americans. After that, the second largest group of people who are victimized are lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual folks, and that's the second group, LGBT folks. Beyond that, you get into members of religious organizations, religious groups, Muslims, Jews, other faiths that are where people are being discriminated because of their religious beliefs. There are a number of hate crimes in any given year against white folks, against white people, and that's important to document. It is not a massive number of people, though, that are being attacked and intimidated because of their whiteness.
And these people who are committing hate crimes, are they members, as far as we know, AC, of organized groups that have regular meetings and figure out, you know, what kind of attacks they're going to conduct? Or are they just, you know, lone people who are upset and act on their own? What do we know?
You know, the truth is that we don't know that much at this point about who is carrying out these acts. When you look at the web metrics on some of the more organized quasi-paramilitary white nationalist and white supremacist group, there's not a ton of traffic going to their sites. There's not a ton of activity there. But we really don't know if we're looking at organized acts of racist terrorism or if we're looking at sort of lone actors, people more in what we would say in the Dylann Roof category, the young man who went and killed folks at the African-American church in South Carolina. It's really unclear. And I think, honestly, there hasn't been great journalistic reporting or great law enforcement investigation on this subject.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about hate crimes in this country since the election. A.C. Thompson, investigative news reporter with ProPublica, is our guest this part of the show. We have a line open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network. Our next caller is Steve in Stevens Point. Hi, Steve.
Hello, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure, Steve. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to make a quick comment. Your caller or your guest was commenting about the uniform crime reporting. I do have some background in that area as being a retired police officer. In that, when he's talking about having it mandated for all law enforcement to do some sort of crime reporting, that is something that's easier said than done, because the point being made is that most law enforcement in this country is very rural law enforcement. We're talking about very small agencies. If they have one or two police officers, they're well staffed at that point. And trying to make mandatory reporting on everything is quite difficult, because that would mean you would have to take a police officer off the street and off the calls to public protection to deal with these paperwork in order to do those things. Being voluntary reporting, it makes it quite difficult, especially when there's no funding involved with those type of mandates.
Police
officers and sheriffs to basically hire with no funding involved to make reporting to the federal government.
Is it a complicated process, Steve? Steve, is that a complicated process? Would it take a lot of time to make a report?
Well, it depends on the situation. It also depends on definitions of what those crimes are being reported as when it comes to that. And I will say, first off, there needs to be greater training amongst law enforcement nationwide as to what an actual hate crime is.
Mm-hmm.
There are states that are more and more robust in that area than are others. But, you know, simply because somebody makes a racial slur doesn't necessarily mean that that person's going to jail. On that. So it needs to have some parameters and definitions that are more easily calculated and therefore can be documented properly.
Mm-hmm. We don't have those, AC?
You know, so basically the laws, the hate crimes laws, vary widely from state to state, right? So in some states, your sexual orientation is not going to be covered by hate crimes laws. In other states, it will. In some states, the way the law works is if you commit an assault and it's believed that you committed this assault because you, for example, dislike white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, then there can be an enhancement that's attached to the charge and will add to the amount of time you would spend in prison if convicted. The laws vary, but what the federal law that says, hey, report this stuff, says is, you know, police, if you're encountering crimes that are motivated by any of the following, dislike of somebody's ethnicity, dislike of somebody's race, dislike of somebody's sexual orientation, dislike of somebody's religious affiliation and adherence, then you need to report that to us. So it's a pretty simple list that's there from the federal law, but I agree with your caller. There definitely needs to be more support to law enforcement to make sure that hate crimes, as well as all other crimes that happen, can be documented well, can be submitted to the FBI, can give us a true picture of what's going on in the country. And I absolutely agree with your caller that part of this is about training, that even where you have the laws on the books in different states, even where you have the federal mandate that says, you know, please report this to us, a lot of police officers, sheriff's deputies, don't always know that they're encountering a hate crime when they see one.
Do you think that the reporting process, AC, is onerous?
You know, I've heard that in different contexts. For example, the military police forces do not report to the UCR, to the FBI's Uniform Crime Report System. And they say, like, it's just too much of a pain for us to do that. So in the Army, you have, like, 14,000 crimes a year that don't go into the federal crime stats. I'm not convinced that for a lot of police departments, this is impossible. I think it is a possible thing to do without a ton more funding.
Steve, thanks so much for your call. Lou in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Lou.
Hey, good afternoon. And I somewhat agree with the previous caller, but I truly think we all know what hate is and we all know what a hate crime is, basically. And I truly think that unless we let go of this racist attitude as a nation, then you're still going to have that good old boy mentality, especially in the South. And I have lived in the South, and I will never return there again to live because of how backward thinking I found it at that point. Until we let go of the racist attitudes, we're still going to have that good old boy where they protect each other. These local agencies are, you know, not going to report everything because they're going to cover for each other. They're going to handle it themselves. And the FBI and the government can require all they want and create as much red tape as they want and as many hoops. But it doesn't mean that the local boys are going to report, especially if they all have an agreement of how to handle it themselves. This is how, really, I mean, I've seen various examples throughout my life living in the South, and I just feel that, you know, it's going to be useless. Really, as a nation, we need to let go of the racism. It's 2016, almost 2017. It's about time to grow up.
Time to get rid of the racism, and most would agree with that. To be fair to the South, though, these hate crimes have been reported since the election in all 50 states. Not just in the South, right, AC?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that, you know, when you have the notion that, hey, it's too soon to tell if we are seeing a spike in hate crimes due to the election, what we can do is we can go back and we can look at 2015 and figure that the election really kicked off in the middle of that year, and we can't prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that there was a connection between the rhetoric employed in the election and the increase in hate crimes. But there definitely was an increase in hate crimes in that year. I would venture to say, based on the early returns, when the data comes out for 2016, we will see another increase in hate crimes in this year, in which we had the second half of the election campaign and the actual voting and election of our new president.
We have less than a minute left, but Claire, you can keep it to a minute, right? Claire in Madison, hi.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. I'll certainly try.
All right.
What inspired me was Muhammad's call from the first half hour from Milwaukee talking mm-hmm. about the problems he's had. And I instantly thought of the infamous Sheriff David Clark, who's being considered for Homeland Security by Trump. This man, Clark, said, bring out the pitchforks and torches at a Trump rally. This is what we have to look forward to in this nation, and it absolutely terrifies me, Kathleen.
Thank you, Claire, very much for the call. Are you terrified at the road ahead, AC?
You know, I'm greatly concerned. This is something that is unprecedented, like I said, as far as I can tell, in the last 50 years, probably longer. It is very, very concerning. And I have a real worry that there isn't a lot of will at the federal level at this point to confront what we're seeing.
Thank you, AC, for being with us and for the work with ProPublica.
Thank you.
AC Thompson, he's been doing investigative reporting for a long time, ProPublica, and before that, San Francisco Weekly. Before that, San Francisco Bay Guardian. He is also working with PBS Frontline series, and he is the author of the book Torture Taxi on the Trail of the CIA's Rendition Flights. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this program, and to KP as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee. News is coming up, and then how important it is to have a dog at work.